Miss Margot Gore, Reel 3.
Well, by the time the end, we were getting ab initio pilots from the WAF. So they were actually taught to fly from scratch and then went on and did conversion courses. So they came to us, of course, with a much shorter background of flying. They hadn't done the amount of hours that we'd done before we started. So one had to be a great deal more careful about them because, as I say, they'd had no experience at all. Most of them did quite a lot of work on Fairchilds, bringing the Fairchild, and then an experienced pilot took over and flew the passengers. So they got their hours that way, and then they gradually went on to conversion courses for Harvards, and some of them did get on the Spitfires and so on.
Where did they take their conversion courses? At Hamel?
They learnt at somewhere near Tame, ab initio, and then went to White Waltham for their conversion courses, and then were posted to the pools.
So you weren't actually ever doing any tuition?
No. We were entirely operational, not training at all. Just my job as a commanding officer was to run the pool, for which I had an adjutant who did all the adjutant's duties, two operations officers, a Met office, a Met officer and a sergeant. We had an MT section with vehicles. We had quite a big engineering section with male engineers for maintaining our taxi aircraft. And we had a canteen with quite a lot of staff.
What was the ratio of women to men?
You mean, we only had male engineers. We had no males in the pool at all, other than we had a flight captain and his first officer, and I think we had about 15 engineers who actually maintained our aircraft, our taxis. And one just had to coordinate the running of the pool so that the pilots always had a meal when it was necessary, and met forecasts when they required it, and that they had vehicles to fetch them, and taxi aircraft to fetch them, and the operations officers did the all the telephoning and the coordinating of picking pilots up. They were not permitted to give an aircraft to a pilot for the first time. In other words, if one had, say, a Tempest came on the books, either I or my second-in-command would have to say that a particular pilot who had not flown a Tempest before could have it. And then once she'd had one, she could have another one. But only the senior flying person on duty could actually give a new type of aircraft to a new pilot.
What sort of flying hours were the women putting in per week?
Oh, it varied very much. A lot of flights and not many hours, because of course when you're flying a Spitfire from Hamble to Cologne, it only took probably 20 minutes, but you had a takeoff and landing, which were the operative things. If you were taking a four-engine aircraft from the south coast up to Kinloss, well, then you put in several hours. But our sort of flying was probably the most dangerous of all, because it's the takeoff and the landing which is the dangerous thing, not the flying, except the weather, of course. But you might fly three aircraft in the day and only put in an hour 20 minutes. But the tricky thing was taking it off and landing it.
So what did they do when they weren't flying?
If we were grounded for bad weather, well, you hung about in the mess. They played bridge, and they sewed, and they read. And then if the weather was quite hopeless, you washed them out and you let them go, and they went back to their digs, or they went into Southampton, or they We were rationed for petrol, of course. If you saved your ration up, you might go up to Winchester or go shopping in Winchester or Southampton. But you tried to let them go if you possibly could. You tried not to keep them about, unless there was something absolutely vital, like a priority one aircraft, and then you had to just wait and sit wherever you were. But it was quite a complex job fitting in a day's program when you might get a Spitfire to Bryce Norton and then picked up at Bryce Norton and taken down to Yeovil and pick up a Seafire and take it to Leon Solent, and then perhaps at Leon Solent there might be a Walrus which had to be taken over to Cowes. And it was a jigsaw that you tried to fit it in to get the maximum from each pilot with as little time hanging about as possible. And waste as little petrol in taxi flights as you could. I mean, you had to think of it. It would have been easier to have rushed about in your Anson's and Fairchild's and taken people willy-nilly from A to B, but you had to think about wasting petrol. At least they told us we had to.
Who's actually giving you your instructions?
Headquarters at White Waltham. We had senior commanders there who issued instructions, and our aircraft came from Andover, which was a central place where the movement of aircraft for ferrying was centred, and they rang all the pools with aircraft during the night that had to be moved, numbers and all the rest of it, and then the operations officers would produce a chit about that size. And you wrote the name of the pilot and the aircraft and the number and where it was and where it had to go to. And, you know, you went off with your chit and then you tore off a bit and you handed it to the man in charge at the aerodrome. And you signed a lot of things to say you'd accepted the aircraft and it was in working condition and all the rest of it. Then you took off. Having been rooted out by flying control, you had to tell them who you were and where you were going, and then the operations officers could ring the place and say, has Spitfire number so and so and so and so taken off to Hyattle or wherever it was, and they'd say yes, it took off at 1720 or whatever, its ETA is 1780 or whatever it was. Then I think we started flying quite a lot of mosquitoes from the south, and they were, I think in 1942 we started moving mosquitoes, and those you had to be a bit careful who you put on to. They were a bit tricky. They were lovely aircraft when they were in the air, but when you were taking them off and landing them, they had certain vices which you had to watch your step with them.
Like what, for instance?
Well, if you got fraction too slow, they fell out of the sky rather smartly. And you had to be careful that you didn't overheat, and you had to do all sorts of things. You had to watch your step with them. They were inclined to bite. But our next sort of landmark was in 1943. We got a contract in the area for Halifax's being converted at Cunley Ferns. So we had to move Halifax's. So they sent, I was sent up first to Marston Moor in May. Yes, May. And I did a conversion course on the Halifax's at the RAF station. Although we had an ATA senior BOAC pilot doing the instruction, the RAF maintained the aircraft, and they were their aircraft. And I did, I think, 3 hours 35 duo on a four-engine, with about four terrified flight engineers also doing a flight engineer's conversion course, hanging over my shoulder. absolutely horrified, I think, at the idea of, I think they were horrified at the idea of a woman flying a Halifax with them on board. But we did 3 hours 35, and then I had to do not very long solo circuits and bumps. And we had to have radio for them, so you had to learn radio procedures in the circuit. And I think I hadn't done very many solo flights when I landed and taxied up to dispersal area and then took a car to flying control to report in. And I came up the steps and I met at the top of the stairs into flying control an Air Vice Marshal. So I said, "Good morning, you see, sir." And he looked at me and he said, "By God, I've seen everything now," because he'd heard me on the RT in the place. And he said, "Who's that, you see?" And they said, "Oh, that's one of the ATA women doing a conversion course." He said, I've got to see this. So he waited for me, and of course, I'm not very big, you see. And when I came into flying control, it really did, it did shatter him. He said he'd seen everything. So he left me to it then. And then we had a lot of Halifaxes, so two other of my pilots, my second-in-command, Rosemary Rees, Lady De Crow, and Philippa Bennett, they did conversion course too, so we moved.
Did you enjoy them?
Yes, I liked them very much indeed. I thought they were very interesting. And we also had two women flight engineers. One from my old school, Janice Harris. What's her name? Janice. It's gone. She came from Bedford and was killed in a mosquito. And we had two others. We had three women flight engineers who had done engineering courses before the war, and they were very good and very good flight engineers indeed. And we had two men, and I flew with Freddie Laker, who was a flight engineer in the ATA. And we also had quite a big contract then for Lancasters, which were the nicest of all. They were nicer than the Halifax. They were lovely. We moved a lot of those.
Why were they so popular?
There's something about an aeroplane which is very difficult to describe. Some are just nicer to fly than others. They handle, like a car handles, nice car handles better. They just handle better. And perhaps the layout's more convenient. I don't know. The Boston was a lovely twin, which was nicer than many of them, and the Lancaster was nicer than the Halifax. And I preferred it also to the Fortress, because we had to move. Air Service Training did some conversions on Fortresses, so I got about five out of Hamble and five in, which was not quite so funny because it's not very big. They were much more complicated because everything in the American machines were electrical. You had lots of little switches, and everything was electrical, and it made it just that much more complicated. And I didn't think they were more lumbering, whereas the Lancaster, you felt, had a sort of, was more like an eager horse wanting to gallop off. But we were flying all these aircraft, and then, of course, when the invasion came, we were very much a prohibited area at Hamble. They used the Winchester Bypass as a great park. It was lined with tanks and trucks, absolutely like that, you know, side by side. And nobody could come in or go out. And we were very short of food, fresh food. And then the Solent began to fill. It was packed, nose to tail, side to side of ships, every kind. I mean, we knew it was coming. We didn't know where. And one day, I'd taken an Anson to pick some pilots up, to Hallavington, which is in Wiltshire. And there was the most enormous excitement and busyness going on. There were a lot of gliders there, a lot of Hamilcars. And they were painting the aircraft with black and white stripes under the wing. And when I went back, I said to the people in operations, something's happening, something's going to happen very, very soon. And I think it was two nights later, I wakened in the night, I had a cottage down near the river, which I shared with two other people. And I heard an absolute constant drone going overhead, and an awful wind was blowing. Terrible, terrible weather. And then I could hear boats in the river. And the next day, I got up early, and went out, and the Hamble was empty, and the Solent was empty, and they'd gone. The invasion was on. And we were grounded that day. There was no flying. And we just all sat by the radio listening. And, it was very exciting, really. There were trucks going, and the soldiers were moving, and the ships were coming and going, and, the invasion was on, of course, and we were very much the centre of it, because it was the nearest. But if the Germans had had an air force at that stage, they could have absolutely obliterated it, because the ships were absolutely moored alongside each other. It was black. Between Cowes and Hamble and Southampton and Eastleigh and all that part, you couldn't put your finger between the ships. There were so many of them. And the river itself was massed with all sorts of landing craft. And, of course, the gliders were going over. They were going to Arnhem. And then, of course, we had the next enormous excitement was that the aircraft had to be taken over to the continent. Well, at first, when the actual fighting was still on the coastline, we took aircraft to what they called group support units. Not maintenance units, but group support units. There was one at Lasham, and there was another one along towards Biggin Hill. And the Air Force collected their own aircraft, because they were going straight to squadrons then. And they were armed, and the radios were fitted before we took them. And we were flying like mad things, Spitfires, Tempest, Mosquitoes, a lot, flying them into these aerodromes, which again would have been a sitting target for the Germans, because there were literally hundreds dispersed all around these aerodromes. And then once the battle had moved inland and further away, we had a big group support unit in Brussels, and they were flown over to Brussels, and we did take them to Brussels. But there was a lot of controversy about whether we should have taken them sooner, and some of the men did. And a lot of the women were at me and at Pauline Gar, my superior, as to why we shouldn't have flown them sooner to the continent. And I felt very strongly about it, because I felt we were fighting a war. And the one thing that we shouldn't do was to be a nuisance. Not for our own amusement and pleasure, anyway. And I didn't back them until it was reasonably safe. I mean, we would have been an unmitigated nuisance if we had crashed when the Germans were still about. We were going to cause loss of life to somebody else, possibly, trying to rescue us. We would have been a nuisance. I wouldn't support it at all. But once the battle had moved on, it was reasonable. We could fly just as well to Brussels as we could to Lasham or Biggin Hill. And we did. And some of them from other pools went further into Germany behind the lines. But it was a very exciting time, and you did feel that you were in the middle of a very great epic. With so much going on. You saw it all firsthand. It wasn't just a photograph. You saw the tanks and the landing craft and the ships and the Mulberry Harbours and all the rest of it. But I think that was perhaps our most exciting time, and we probably moved more aircraft over that period than ever before. They were there to be moved, and they had to be moved. And that was, well, getting towards the end of our time then. We had another year perhaps, but it got less busy then. The war was won, really.
But the Southampton area was badly attacked during the war. How did you cope with that?
Well, they never actually... They only got us once on the aerodrome. That was one lone aircraft. I think the worst, really, was losing sleep, in that we had incessant air raids in 42, 43, when we had aircraft overhead and they were bombing Cowes and they were bombing Southampton and Portsmouth. And you didn't get your sleep. Because, I mean, if it wasn't the bombs dropping, it was anti-aircraft waking you up. And they tried to make us do fire watching. And I had a running battle with the local civil defence, because I said they could not expect pilots to sit up all night fire watching and then fly next day. It wasn't the same as going into an office job where they could doze off if they were tired. They didn't seem to understand this, but then I beat them. I wouldn't let them insist. It wasn't fair. It wasn't on. But we did get very tired over that worst period.
How did the girls manage to fly after not sleeping properly?
Well, I think you had to. You know, when you have to do something, you do it. Sometimes we used to. I personally, when I'd finished, I used to try and have a sleep before the night. And if it started in the night and there was a lot of banging and booshing going on, I used to come down. We'd all come down and have tea, which was the best thing to do, really. But I used to try and get a sleep. Perhaps at about 6 or 7, something like that. I was tired enough to sleep at any time, so you could get off. And then it got better. I mean, once our air force had gained supremacy, the bombers didn't get through as often. I think we had the first flying bomb. It landed in the mud flats, the other side of the Hamble. And they came over very incessantly until the invasion, and I think we took Dieppe, which was where they were coming from, and they stopped just like that, and then they were going to London. And I saw quite a lot when I was flying. You could see them. We used to fly above them. There was a height they flew at. I've forgotten what it was. I think it was 3,000 feet. But if you flew at 4, you could look down and see them. That was quite exciting too. I mean, we were very glad when they moved away from us, because that was rather startling, in that you heard them, which made a most awful noise, and then the engine cut and you were waiting for it to drop on you.
Were some types of aircraft more popular than others?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Spitfire was the most popular, and the Hurricane, and people liked the Mosquito. There was one aircraft that none of us liked, and that was the Air Cobra, which was a tricycle undercarriage American aircraft, which was landed in great numbers to be in crates from America at Cunliffe Ferns. They were reassembled, they were tested, and we flew them up to Cosford in the Midlands, where they were then taken to pieces and recreated and sent to Russia. And the Russians apparently wouldn't have them unless they'd been test flown and assembled in England and then sent on. They were horrible aeroplanes. We had quite a lot of forced landings with them. But for some reason or other, when you switched from one wing tank to another, which you had to do occasionally, the engine used to cut out. And I think we had two of our pilots that had to force land them and got away with it very well indeed. They also had an engine at the rear, so you felt that if you crashed in them, the engine was going to come through your back and the propeller shaft was through your legs to the propeller in front. You also couldn't see out of them very well because they had a very thick armour-plated windscreen through which you could see very little, so you were always navigating by looking backwards. So people really didn't like them very much, and we had a short period when we all had to pull our socks up and get rid of them and fly them as fast as we could out of the area. But nobody liked them. There was only one aircraft that I actually physically couldn't fly, and that was a Tomahawk. And it, for some reason, it had rather... My legs were too short, and you had toe brakes. And when you took off, you had to have the stick hard back into your tummy, which locked the tail wheel, which kept you straight while you were running. And then your tail came off the ground, and you got the stick forward. And if I could lock the tail wheel, I couldn't reach the rudder bar. So I had to say I couldn't fly it. I was just too short. If I had a cushion, you see, I couldn't lock the tail wheel. And if I hadn't a cushion, I couldn't reach the rudder bar, which was not adjustable enough. But most of the girls were slightly bigger than I was, so they had no difficulties. And they had to take what they were given.
Did they ever refuse?
No, they couldn't refuse.
What would have happened if they had?
I would have shunted them all somewhere else if they had. I mean, they were never asked to do something that was unreasonable. So that if there was a good reason for them not flying something, like I couldn't fly a Tomahawk, they naturally wouldn't be given it. But because they just didn't like an aircraft or didn't like an open aircraft, that just didn't wash. I mean, and they didn't. I mean, they were all very honest, good, dedicated pilots who were doing something they loved to do. And they wouldn't have refused, ever. And nobody ever did. So that was that.